But I'll just make this one comment, though. But you can see, as homosexuality started, the traditional view was that it's a sin, it's criminal behavior. Then by the time of Freud, there's no place for sin anymore. So then but we still had those laws on the books, but with Freud, all of a sudden the thinkers of Western civilization saying, no, homosexuality is just an aberrant mental illness. But by 1973, the psychological community in America said, no, it's not even a mental illness anymore, it's just an alternative lifestyle. And now it's being viewed as wholesome behavior. Okay? Now, where's Christianity on this chart?
He's a flop, way back there.
Yeah. Christianity started as, in America, as a wholesome behavior. Then it's like, well, you know, it's an alternative. I mean, it's okay, but that's just for you. It's not for me. And then we started talking in our Ivy League schools about it being like a mental illness. And now we've entered the stage where Christianity is being viewed as wrong, and if not criminal, hate speech, terrorism, whatever. And so we're just like two ships passing in the night. And
at what point are we both mentally ill?
What's that?
Where's the crossing point where we're all mentally ill?
Yeah, no, I'm just saying we just, yeah, yep. And but whatever the case, you know, and the crazy thing is, what is going on right now, there's a sense where it's totally anti-constitutional. But there's also a sense where it's very, very constitutional. Where it's anti-constitutional is the Founding Fathers acknowledge our Constitution. Political freedom means the freedom to govern yourself without interference from the government. And so we need a limited amount of government. So you're free to do as you choose, so long as you don't infringe on somebody else's freedoms. But the Founding Fathers realized there's some issues, like human sexuality, where we pretty much, to have order in a society, we got to make choices. So the Founding Fathers recognized that as long as the vast majority of Americans were Christian in their views of morality, then we're going to be able to handle governing ourselves. But the Founding Fathers, and this is where what's going on right now is very constitutional, the Founding Fathers gave us enough freedom to blow it, to throw it all away. And so in other words, when a free people become pagan in their moral views, because of their freedom and their political say, they can turn, you know, their nation and their government, they could turn their nation into one big prison camp. And that's pretty much the direction we're heading. And so like John Adams said, that our Constitution was made solely for a religious people. When we cease to be religious, we're going to cease to be free. Ben Franklin, a lady asked at the Constitutional Convention, what form of government have you given us? He said, a constitutional republic, if you can keep it. So what what they both understood was the people have enough power. The government's protecting our freedom, our God-given rights and our freedom. But in a free society, the people have enough power to say, never mind, we don't want it anymore. And that's what's going on, is we're using our freedom. Instead of using our freedom to be all that God called us to be, we Americans are now using our freedom to force our people to accept our sinful behavior. And but you know, we in the midst of the anarchy, it's kind of like, let's use the government to take money from other people and give it to me. Let's use the government to force other people to embrace and promote my sinfulness and things of that sort. So you know, so we live in a crazy time. So, okay. Would you like to lead us in a word of prayer?
Dear Lord, thank you. Thank you for this class, for this opportunity to grow, to learn, to be able to present our Christian views to others so that they would be drawn to you. I ask you for your guidance and your presence here with us at this time. In Jesus' name.
Amen. Well, one more comment here. When your behavior is viewed as sinful and criminal, you're forced into the closet. Okay? And so as homosexuals come out of the closet, guess who's having to start go into the closet? And then, in other words, eventually the church in America is going to be, if we continue on this route towards madness, this road towards madness, we're going to be like China. We're going to have an underground church. So, and you'll still have big church buildings and stuff like that, but they'll be like Europe. They'll either be museums or places for people who call themselves Christians, but their Christianity has changed even worse than like Joel Osteen. It's going to be more like the, you know, the churches that ordain homosexuals, and if you're a homosexual, you're on a fast track to, you know, becoming the head bishop or whatever, and but the real churches are going to be meeting in secret in the homes, and Christians will be forced in the closet. So that's the kind of world we face. So. Oh yeah! Oh yeah! Yeah, it. I would agree. For he said, for those watching on video, that the national tendency towards man is fascism. Yeah, the natural tendency towards man is towards evil, and so it's gonna. This is why I'm opposed to us toppling regimes in the Middle East, and then setting up puppet governments, thinking that's going to make the world a better place to live. The only way they're going to get freedom in the Middle East is if they trash the Quran. And I don't think we even have the right to force them to trash the Quran. So basically what they do in the Middle East, if you give them so-called democracy, the right to vote, then what it is, they're not voting for freedom. They're going to, this guy, I'm going to vote for a guy who thinks like me, to be a tyrant and force everybody else to get with my program. And you're going to vote for a guy who thinks like you to force everybody. As long as they still embrace the Quran, it's going to be tyranny. And then, so there's an example. The Islamic faith is an example where I think man, just left to himself in his natural state, has a tendency towards big government and tyranny, fascism. The founding fathers, even the ones that were not Bible-believing Christians, they still embraced the biblical view of government, of limited government, and the biblical view of morality. And that's why we've experienced so much freedom here. I think a lot of people in the Christian right are Christian socialists, that we think, okay, well, God instituted the human government to enforce Christian morality. No, God's the moral governor of the universe. It's not the government's job. You know, we Christians applaud every time the government intervenes because they don't like the way parents are raising children, and we fail to realize how our government often does, and will do so to a greater degree, will intervene because we're bringing up our kids in a Christian home. And but we fail to realize the government has a certain amount of authority, but so do parents in the home. And but we want the government. There are certain Christians who want the government to do everything the church is supposed to do and everything the parents are supposed to do and everything. So we've got a bunch of Christian socialists who want big government forcing Christian morality on the masses. And that's just as bad as wanting anti-Christian morality forced on the masses. Either way, you still get big, ugly government. Big government is always bad. And that's like the right to bear arms doesn't sound like, wow, that's a, that doesn't sound like a big Christian issue. Well, it should be, because if the only way you can protect your family is by calling 911, you have blind trust in the government. And the government's not going to get there in time. They don't need to bring their pistols. They can just bring the chalk and outline the body of whoever lost, the little battle that went on when somebody breaks in, into your house. So, but you hear Fox News, you know, they're supposed to be the conservatives, and they're whining and crying about, oh, if just one of those Marines was armed, they'd be alive right now, and all this other stuff because of that terrorist act on the Marines. And well, I'm a former Marine, and I'm offended by that statement. And the reason why I'm offended by that statement is because Fox News never said that about the South Carolina church, the Christians.
Exactly.
If one of them had been, so all of us, so I mean, is that what, you know, is Fox News fascist enough to think that only the Marines got the right to protect themselves? You know, it's just like, be consistent here, and wouldn't it be nice if the pastor or somebody else in his church was armed, so that, you know, that poor, that young guy that was protecting, his, trying to protect his grandmother that got killed, I wish he was armed, you know? And the guy reloaded like five times. And so if you're just arguing that Marines stationed in America should be armed, if the public aren't, the Founding Fathers would be up, because they didn't like great British, armed British troops walking around. Now, if the public is just as armed as the Marines are on American soil, then the Founding Fathers say, okay, now you can have freedom. And see, the God instituted human government to spank the bullies. But if human government goes way beyond what it's supposed to do, it becomes the biggest bully, and it's got a monopoly on the bullying. So so you're in worse shape. Okay, so now we're going to talk about philosophy of religion. Yeah.
I want to bring up something that applies to what we've been dealing with here. I just heard a report on the radio as I was driving here that a man had fired a gun, it went through the ceiling of an apartment and killed a woman below. And the comment was that if this man had been deported when he should have, this woman would not have died.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that fit into the picture, what we said? But God foreknew that she would die in this way.
Yeah, whatever God, everything that occurs, not only did God foreknow it, but he had to allow it. And in my understanding, if he allowed it, it's as good as predetermined that it's going to happen. But it would be like a parent. If a parent was all-knowing, which no human parent is, but if a parent was all-knowing, it would be like saying, look, I know if I let my son borrow the car tonight, he's going to get in a horrible accident and lose both his legs. But I also know that more good is going to come out of that than evil. So I'm going to allow it. So he's not just like the parent that recognizes as my children get older, I just have to allow them, permit them some freedom. It's worse than that. God knows exactly what they're going to do with that freedom. But the only way to nail God for being unjust would be if he foreknew that no good or less good would come out of it than the evil, and then he still allowed it. Now, how God can bring more good than the evil out of the Holocaust than the evil of the Holocaust, I don't know. That's his business. I will say this, the Holocaust was not the most unjust act in human history. Most unjust act in human history was when we slaughtered the perfect human who also happened to be God. God visited this planet. And look ahead, was God able to bring good out of Jesus' death? Yes, we'd all be hellbound. So if God can bring good, a greater good, out of the greatest injustice committed in human history, then he's infinitely wise. He's able to bring good out of less injustices. And and so basically, God's going to bring some kind of good out of that. And But I tell you, we're the way we deal with immigration is insane. I'm just getting fed up with what's going on with terrorism, and I don't know if anybody's going to listen to just the pastor or whatever, but I just need to get it off my chest, so someday we'll make a 3-minute YouTube video, put it on Sermon Audio too, on what needs to be done to combat terrorism. And it's not what needs to be done to stop terrorism. As long as there are sinful humans, it's going to be terrorism. But what needs to be done is not. We're not even hearing it on Fox News. Fox News acts like if the president just calls Islamic terrorism Islamic, we'll save the day. Well, this is a lot more than that.
When they call them ISIL, I mean, the same thing. When the president says that, it's basically saying that Israel doesn't have a right to their homeland.
Mm-hmm.
And I get offended whenever it comes to
by basically giving them credibility by giving them a name, is that what you mean, instead of calling them terrorists?
What I'm saying is they call them ISIL. President and all of his administration uses this ISIS thing. They call them ISIL, ISIL.
Uh-huh.
The Islamic State in Syria and the Levant. The Levant is an area.
Oh, sure.
When they say that, they're basically saying they're delegitimizing Israel as a land, homeland, when they use the ISIL, that acronym.
Yeah, and I think the president on that issue, I don't think he's as Muslim as a lot of people think he is. I think he's just into Nietzsche's will to power. And so I just think that there are many globalists who, like one of the Rockefellers said, if we had to do it all over again, we would have given the Jews Arizona. So it failed. We wanted to get more influence. The West wanted to get more influence in the Middle East by having an ally there. So the Jews needed a place to stay after the Holocaust, so give them back their biblical homeland. Well, that's given us less influence in the Middle East, not more. So there are a lot of globalists, like Henry Kissinger said, about a year ago, that 10 years from now, Israel will not exist as a state. And what he's basically saying is, we're going to Plan B. And Plan B, we want influence in the area. Let's just befriend the majority of the countries there. Let's befriend the Muslim Arabs and take Israel out. But, Henry Kissinger wants to take on Israel, fine. But he's going to find out that one Jew is going to come back that's a lot bigger than little pudgy Henry Kissinger is. So, but whatever the case, in the end, we do, well, maybe during the break, I'll outline what needs to be done. And, okay, so now, philosophy of religion, what is the ultimate? Non-philosophical anti-intellectualists like the Kitsap County Human Rights Council, when they asked me what my doctorate degree was in, I said philosophy of religion, and they acted like it wasn't a serious topic. So it's just like, well, that's just because you've never studied philosophy. You're not really a thinker in any sense of the term. They're just politically correct ignoramuses is all they were. And but whatever the case, there are atheists like Jeffrey J. Louder who is upset when they close down philosophy of religion departments or they don't have courses in philosophy of religion. Because see, when an atheist debates a Christian, that's in the philosophy of religion. So this isn't only Christians like philosophy of religion. No. People who hate Christianity like philosophy of religion as well. Muslims like philosophy of religion. I mean, there's nothing in man alien to the religious. So, but the philosophy of religion answers the question, what is the ultimate? And we've got several sections. So we're not going to be able to do them all justice, but the first is going to be, what's the relationship between faith, God's revelation to us and our faith in it, faith and reason, human thinking ability. After that, we're going to need to, we're not going to be able to spend much time on any of these, but then what is meant by God? Different worldviews. Then we'll talk about some of the traditional arguments for God's existence. How can we talk about God? And the problem of evil. And then can we experience God? I don't even know if we're going to get to that. So those are some of the different subjects. Now, as a guy who's got his PhD in philosophy of religion, this is like I could devote my whole life to studying these questions. Like just arguments for God's existence and the problem of evil, I'd be content to just spend my entire life, you know, working on that. But whatever the case, so let's take a look at faith versus reason. You could just, if you got a, well, you got that page right next to the faith and reason. Take this page here, maybe, if you want, and just write this chart on there. And so I'm not going to stick by the notes much on this. And we'll just put faith, which is trusting in God's revelation, your beliefs. So faith here is being handled when it's on this extreme, no reason at all. And then reason here, where there's no faith at all. Now, by the way, you can be, in this sense, you can be an ultra-rationalist, yet be an empiricist. Somebody who believes knowledge is through the five senses. All we mean by reason here is human thinking ability. So it doesn't have to be detached from knowledge of the senses and stuff like that. This is just human thinking ability, and this is faith totally apart from reason. Now, there was another point I was going to make, and I can't remember. Oh, yeah, I would say this. One thing we Christians need to understand is that the Christian view of reason, Thomas Aquinas really spelled this out well, but the Christian view of reason, with Augustine, the Christian view of reason, what turns the light on? In God's light we see light. So a Christian view of reason, even our reasoning and thinking and figuring out that this is a bottle of water in my hand, that still necessitates dependence upon God. In him we live and move and have our being, Paul quotes a Greek poet in Acts 17. So reason is based on God's revelation in nature, whereas faith is based on, in our way of thinking, God's supernatural revelation, primarily in his word. Okay? But we're just going to see where people line up on this. And on revelation only, faith only, which is also called fideism. Okay? You have people like Soren Kierkegaard, the Danish philosopher, who argued that it's not really important about whether or not Jesus objectively rose from the dead. The important thing is that you believe that he rose from the dead. So Kierkegaard would say your subjective beliefs are much more important than any objective reality. Now, it seems that Kierkegaard did hold to Jesus' resurrection and things of that sort. But what he's basically saying is, unless you subjectively believe in that, it's not going to do you any good. Okay? But he's kind of like out here where it's faith only. taking a leap of blind faith into the non-rational realm on life's most important decisions. Another guy that you could put out here on this extreme would be Karl Barth, the neo-Orthodox theologian, where the Bible is not the Word of God. The Bible contains the Word of God. It's in. It's kind of like when you study the Bible, the words can have mistakes. They can have errors. However, in an existential encounter, during a moment of crisis, you encounter God in His Word, and then it goes beyond reason. So you have an experience. So the Bible is almost, it's almost like the Bible becomes a Ouija board that can put you in contact with God. You can experience God, but then you can't put it into words. And so there, it gets right back to just faith only, okay? Now, on the other extreme, you get an anti-Christian Jewish philosopher, Benedict Spinoza, an ultra-rationalist. Everything can be proven through reason alone, and you don't need revelation from God. And in fact, he didn't even believe in revelation from God. He was his view is pretty close to a pantheist, pretty close to God being everything. He was a little bit different, but for the most part, Benedict Spinoza was an ultra rationalist. But you also get a Christian thinker like Rene Descartes. And Rene Descartes said that we could prove everything through reason alone. And so he wanted to find a point of rational certainty that could not be doubted. And then from that, he was going to try to deduce everything else. The axioms of geometry, the geometric proofs were big back then. He was a mathematician. So he began to doubt everything. He used skepticism as a method until he found something he could no longer doubt. And what that was the more he doubted, the more he recognized the existence of himself, the doubter. And so he said, and since doubting is a form of thinking, he said, I think, therefore I am. And then tried to prove Christianity. But in the meantime, another mathematician around living at the same time, Blaise Pascal, said, look, if we could prove everything through reason alone, then there's no need for revelation from God, special revelation. So you're not going to lead people to Christ. He actually predicted this is going to lead to enlightenment and rationalism, where we're going to try to find all truth and solve all mankind's problems through reason alone. It's actually backfired. See, we fell so in love, because of Christianity, we fell so in love with God's gift to us, human reason. But then eventually we fell so in love with the gift that we forgot about the gift giver. And we started using God's gift to us, human reason, to argue against God. Yet any good Christian philosopher will tell you, if we were not created by a rational God in His image so that through reason we could find truth, then there's no basis for human reason. So Cornelius Van Til, a presuppositional apologist, is real quick to point out that without belief in God, without belief in a rational God, there's no basis for argumentation. So, but whatever the case, Blaise Pascal is kind of over here. Most people would put him all the way over here, and that's because they don't read him as close enough as they should. But Blaise Pascal would say, you know what, unlike these guys, he would say, you know what, reason does work. On the most important issues of life, reason does work. However, Blaise Pascal did not have a low view of human reason. He had a low view of man's use of his reason, because man is fallen. So we might add 2 + 2 and come up with 5. We might get it wrong. So man's fallen, we make mistakes. Man is also finite, limited. So there's only a certain amount that we could do with our reason. And we're so easily distracted. If there's a bug flying around your head, you don't understand what the preacher's saying. That's one of the illustrations he uses in his Poncés. I'd recommend you pick up the Poncés. Blaise Pascal, P-E-N-S-E-E-S, I think is the way it's spelled.
Yeah, P-E-N-S-E-E-S.
I think it's an S. And I'm not even sure about the two E's at the end there, but whatever the case, it means it's just French for thoughts. And he was organizing his own defense of the Christian faith. It was as much a refutation of René Descartes' ultra-rationalism as it was his own defense of the faith. But he's basically saying, look, human reason works, but we fallen humans are so dishonest, very rarely do we use our reason in an honest manner. So Blaise Pascal said, look, we decide on our most important issues, we decide what we're going to believe totally apart from reason. And then we sneak reason in the back door to defend those beliefs. So
the way we vote.
Okay, the way we vote, the way we do just about anything. So Blaise Pascal had a real good understanding of man's psychological, emotional makeup. That's why his wager argument that because there's a possibility of infinite gain if you wager on God and win, and no possibility of loss if you wager on God and lose, whereas if you wager against God, you got the possibility of infinite loss and no possibility of gain. He's saying, so the wise man's going to wager on God. So he says only two kinds of people could be called wise. Those who serve God with all their hearts because they know him, and those who seek God with all their hearts because they don't know him. And but only a fool, according to Pascal, would wager his life like God doesn't exist. So his wager argument is not actually an argument for God's existence. It's an argument that before you look at the evidence for or against God, you ought to be biased. We never look at evidence in an unbiased manner. And if you have to be biased on one side or the other, there's good reasons for you to be biased towards God, not against God. And see, if you and an atheist are driving, and you're driving in your car, you got an atheist in the passenger side seat, and you're debating God's existence, a drunk driver swerves into your lane, hits you, kills you both, the atheist can't even turn to you and say, hey, you were right. Okay? And Douglas Grotius from Biola University's Talbot School of Theology, he said Pascal's wager argument only works if the evidence for or against God is 50-50, if it's equal. And I told him after his lecture, I said, I don't want to say anything public, but you're not correct on that. I think it was Richard Creel brought up the illustration. If your child gets lost in the woods, and a search party has been looking for 48 hours and can't find them, and then the sheriff comes up to you and said, look, we haven't found your child. There's only a 1% chance your child, it's really cold out there, it's beast out there, wild beast. There's only a 1% chance your child is still alive. Is it okay if we give up the search? What are you going to say? You're going to say no. Just if there's any possibility that my child is still alive, there's so much to gain by continuing the search and nothing to lose by continuing the search. Let's continue the search. And so if there's any possibility, so Blaise Pascal's wager argument actually works if there's any chance that God exists. Even Richard Dawkins admits there's a possibility that God exists. So, but the problem is Richard Dawkins isn't as smart as Blaise Pascal. In fact, they try to figure out who's got the highest IQ in the history of philosophy, and Blaise Pascal finished in like the top five or six. That's bogus. If he's not one, two, or three, it's bogus. This dude was like off the charts brilliant. In fact, he wrote the Laws of Probability. He never gambled, but he's the greatest expert on what a good bet is.
Out of curiosity, who did win the number one spot?
I don't remember. I remember looking at it, and that's the one thing that stuck out of my mind. No way this guy's fifth or sixth. He died when he was 39, too. If he lived to be 89...
Wow. They probably put some doofus like Einstein, number one.
I don't know. They had more traditional guys than I thought, which impressed me. But there were a lot of contemporary guys which I thought were overrated. But if he lived to be 89 instead of 39, we'd probably be having this lecture on Mars right now. And I don't even think that's an overstatement. I mean, the calculator, the computer, there's so many things that we take for granted now that he was the guy, you know, inventing the wheel in those areas. And a little sickly guy. Let me see who else we should throw in here. What's that?
They named it programming language after him.
Yeah, he was a brilliant guy. Some other guys here would be some of the higher critics of the scriptures, the guys who say that, you know, they say, no, human reason determines what's true and what's not true from the Bible, and they're usually deists, so miracles didn't occur, we don't believe in miracles. Okay. The two, Cornelius Van Til. Deep down inside, everybody knows that God exists, and he believes that we have to presuppose, just to argue against God, you got to presuppose the existence of God. But where I disagree with him, I think that's a good case for a rational personal God, for theism. But I don't see where you have to presuppose the existence of the triune God, a three-person God. But Augustine and Aquinas, we often put them on opposite ends of the spectrum. But if this is the center right here, I would put Augustine right there and Aquinas right there. Besides the fact that Aquinas was Aristotelian, followed Aristotle, and Augustine was more Platonic, besides that difference in their epistemology, their theory of knowledge, the main difference between them would be that Augustine viewed any knowledge we could attain, whether it was through supernatural revelation or natural revelation, God revealing himself in nature, it's all revelation. So his emphasis was, whether it's through reason or faith, it's all got to be revealed to us from God. Aquinas agrees, but Aquinas believed that God was calling him to draw the distinction between natural revelation, which he called truths of reason, truths that we could find out through reason alone, and then truths of faith, truths that we could only know by studying the scriptures, because if God didn't supernaturally reveal it, we wouldn't figure it out from examining nature. So these guys were both very balanced. Big balance of reason and revelation, big balance on faith and reason. It just, Aquinas is just slightly on the rational side, Augustine just slightly on the faith side, but they actually have a lot more in common than people think. Aquinas in his writings, if he was talking about who he thought the ultimate theologian was, it was Augustine. If he said the philosopher and he didn't say who he's talking about, that's Aristotle. So Aquinas considered himself Augustinian in theology and Aristotelian in his philosophy. Augustine said that faith is understanding step. In other words, trusting in God initiates our knowledge of divine truth. Like the beginning of wisdom, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, Proverbs 1:7. understanding is faith's reward, gives us more complete knowledge of truth. Still, one must have some understanding of what something is before one believes it. But he still believed you could prove God's existence based on unchanging truths. We'll talk about that a little bit later. He did talk about man's sinful nature blinding him to God's truth, but faith leads a man into a fuller understanding of God's revelation. But he's just on the faith side, but he's very balanced. Aquinas would argue that sin hasn't fully destroyed man's reason. You know, a lot of Calvinists really slam Aquinas for that and say, "See, you didn't believe in total depravity." But he actually did believe in total depravity. He wasn't spelled out in his day. He came on the scene, you know, 300 years before Calvin. But his view that sin hasn't fully destroyed man's reason, he's not saying when man does math, he always gets it right. What he's saying is when man does math, sometimes he gets it right. Sometimes we add 2 plus 2 and we actually arrive at 4. So he's not as... in fact, I would actually argue Aquinas, if you really understand what he's talking about, which Van Til did not understand, Schaeffer did not, if you really understand what Aquinas is saying, he's actually way more Calvinistic than most people would think. But he believed that God, through his revelation in nature and through the reason that he's given us, we can prove an awful lot of Christian truth through reason. So whatever the case, one other thing about Aquinas, too, that I'd like to... His distinction between belief in and belief that. Aquinas would say... Belief that is driven by reason. Belief in is driven by faith. So that if you look at the evidence, if you look at the evidence and you're honest with the evidence, use your reason in an honest manner, reason will show you that you should believe that God exists. You should believe that Jesus rose from the dead. You should believe that Jesus is God incarnate. So reason can take you that far. But then you have to say, okay, well, do I want to now believe in Jesus for salvation? So this is an act of the mind. This belief in is an act of the will. So basically what I'm saying is, there is a Kierkegaardian side of Aquinas, but that's after reason has done its job. You still have to decide whether you want to believe in it. Okay? Let's say you get a spoiled, rotten kid. And in this room, I know they're hard to find, and let's say it's pouring rain outside, and the kid just wants to disagree about everything. I want to go outside and play. I want to go outside and play. See, you can't go outside and play. Look, it's raining outside. And he says, it's not raining. It's not raining. Okay? See, his reason is telling him that it's raining, but he's using his will to deny the obvious. And Aquinas says, yeah, an atheist can deny the obvious. Now, I would agree with Calvin about the sensus divinitatis. Calvin, by the way, would be out here, a lot closer to the middle than a lot of Calvinists think, and further here than Van Til was. But Calvin believed in the sensus divinitatis, which means that we not only have the five senses that put us in touch with the physical world, but we also have a sense that puts us in touch with God. So deep down inside, man knows that God exists, Romans 1, but we suppress that truth. And so we have immediate knowledge of God, says Calvin, but there's also a mediate knowledge where our knowledge of God can be mediated through the physical world and all. And so sensus divinitatis would be on the faith side. On the rational side would be the our knowledge of God through the physical things he's created.
Yep. Can you repeat that about the immediate and immediate?
Yeah, with Calvin. Our immediate knowledge of God. And through the sensus divinitatis, our sense of deity. So we have an innate knowledge. Just because we're created human, we have this innate knowledge of God. Now, we could suppress that, but God still proves his existence through us through immediate knowledge of God, and that's through nature, through creation. So mediate means there's something in the middle, something that, you know, if this Bible represents God, and I represent me, if my knowledge of God is mediated through this chair, through something else, I see, oh, God must exist as the maker of the chair or whatever. That's mediate knowledge. You remove the chair, and if I have direct knowledge of God, that's immediate knowledge. And so Calvin says we're born with that. Aquinas would deny that. Because Aquinas, we have no innate ideas. We only have the innate ability. But it's just more of an Aristotelian. He got that from Aristotle. But I would agree with Calvin. Yeah, I'm somewhere in between these two guys, so...
You're right in the middle.
What?
You're right in the middle, then.
Yeah, it's funny how that works. There's probably a lot of guys who would place themselves right. I have the most balanced view, you know. And
it sounds a lot like this entire discussion is closely related to epistemology. Because if I'm a skeptic, then everything around me is based on faith. Because I can't actually say there's any reason for it.
Most skeptics, though, would consider themselves ultra-rationalists.
I think they misdefine skepticism
into just atheism. I think they misdefine reason. Yeah, I think...
I dare anybody in this room to tell me whether or not there's a yellow Volkswagen outside by logic alone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It has to be on faith. But then... If you have...
even if you
could be over there.
But his point is, even if you saw it, you have to have faith in your senses
in order to see.
Yeah, so reason alone deals with things that have to be true by definition, and that's why Aquinas deals with the realm of being. And so he doesn't believe God's existence is logically necessary. He believes it's only actually or existentially necessary because he starts with being. For him, to say something is logically necessary just means it has to exist in the mind. But he wants to know, does God exist outside the mind? And but there's just different categories. But go on with your point there.
So if this is all based on epistemology, I feel like I see where you've been going, having us study epistemology, then metaphysics, then philosophy of religion, because the first two are going to inform this. And my question is, how is this not a branch of epistemology rather than its own branch of philosophy?
Yeah, there's definitely epistemology comes into play totally, in that every one of these guys I'm talking about, their epistemology. But in the branch of philosophy that's called philosophy of religion, the very first question you have to ask is a very epistemologically charged question, but how do you balance faith and reason? Because we're going to be talking about them. And so, but you're exactly right. Sometimes Terry L. Meathey, brilliant scholar, when he gave us the lectures at Liberty University using this textbook, he chose to start with faith and reason first. So this was his first lecture. But by doing that, since his lectures were not coinciding with the chapters, the way Geisler and Feinberg, I got an A on the course, but he must have graded it on a curve, but I actually like the way Geisler handles it. You might like the way Terry Almeti handles it. Let me just say something here before we move on to the next topic, and we'll take a little bit of break. But Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins, he would put himself here, but the key is, the reason why I could put him in both places, he says faith and reason never meet, okay? So he acts like if you can prove something is true, if you have reasons for it, then it's not a faith. It automatically goes into the category of science or reason, okay? And he doesn't realize how many things he has to have faith in before he can even start to do science. Like if you saw the yellow Volkswagen outside and then you believe that there's a yellow Volkswagen outside, you have to have faith in your senses. Well, scientists have to have faith in their senses, and that's not something you can prove. Through science itself. But whatever the case, Dawkins acting like faith and reason, there's no overlap. He fails to realize that very few philosophers have been here with Descartes and Spinoza, and very few philosophers have been here with Kierkegaard and Barth. Almost, in other words, from here, from this point on to here, right before the arrows, that's where you're going to find probably 99.9% of all the philosophers throughout history. There's some overlap between faith and reason. So if you got faith and reason, there's some overlap. Okay? The idea that they are two totally separate things is pretty much, unless you're Kierkegaardian or Barthian, and Dawkins is not, or if you're like Spinoza or Descartes, an ultra-rationalist, and Dawkins is not, unless you're in one of those extreme views, to say this is the way it is a pretty anti-intellectual perspective. And it was so easy to refute John Lennox when John Lennox debated him in their first debate on the existence of God. John Lennox, another Oxford scholar who believes that God exists, and he was just leading on the podium, Lennox was, and Richard Dawkins says, if you could prove something is true, it's no longer faith, it's reason. So anytime a Christian tries to prove their views, so he acts like you Christians can't prove your views. But if you could prove it, it wouldn't be faith anymore, then it'd be reason. So we lose either way. But he said, but faith and reason never overlap. And John Lennox said, Well, come on now, Richard. Surely you must have good reasons for having faith in your wife. And Dawkins said, I do. And then the whole audience laughed at him. And he was the only guy who didn't get it. That he's saying faith and reason never meet, but I have good reasons for having faith in my wife. Well, then they do meet, Richard. And it would be nice if an Oxford scholar could open his mouth for at least 5 minutes without contradicting himself and inserting his foot, but apparently that's not the case. If you hate God and you want to argue against him with all his passion, and then you try to convince people, I don't believe he exists, even though I hate him this much, but I guess if you're that blinded to God, you get blinded to your own contradictions. So that's all we got time for on faith and reason. We'll take a little break, and then we'll move on to talking about